This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 1st of February 2011, our first speaker was Dr. Stephen Dunn, who is Director of Strategy for the NHS in the East of England. He presented a Galbraithian perspective on the relationship between the modern food industry and public health. We then heard a response from Dr. Robert McMaster of the University of Glasgow. You can download slides to accompany the talk from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thank you, Mark, for that very kind introduction and the opportunity to come and speak in Cambridge today. It's quite fitting in that Galbraith spent not 1 year but 2 years at Cambridge. For the first time in the 1937, Keynes had had a heart attack and unfortunately was not around, but Galbraith spent quite a bit of time with the circus and through that gained a clear appreciation of the import of Keynesian analysis and took the message home and was one of the principal advocates of Keynesian economics over the second half of the 20th century. And he returned to Cambridge in the early 1970s and lectured on what was to become economics and the public purpose. So it's very fitting to come back to Cambridge and give a lecture on Galbraith. The book, The Economics of John Kenneth Galbraith, is now out. It's published by Cambridge University Press and it clocks in at just under 500 pages and it's available from all good booksellers including Amazon and CUP if people want to be so availed. I should start with an anecdote. There are none in the book and there is not much humour, which is somewhat surprising given those are trademarks of Galbraith's many contributions over his great life. But he is a serious economist, was perhaps not treated as such, and the book aims to correct that misapprehension. But my favourite Galbraith anecdote was when LBJ interjected when Galbraith was talking on some arcane economics point, and he said something like, "Well, you know, Ken, economics is a bit like pissing down your leg. It sure feels hot to you and no one else." And certainly, I think Galbraith does feel hot to me, but judging by the mainstream reaction, not very warm to them. Although widely read, he is, or widely quoted, he is not much read. His works do not appear in the major journals, and his influence on economics is receding by the year. And I think this is a travesty, and my book attempts to correct that reception. I'd argue, and I will argue over the course of the lecture, that Galbraith was an original theorist who made salient contributions to the theory of the firm, advertising, social policy, monetary economics, methodology, the development of Keynesianism, that is underappreciated, and certainly the book deals with aspects of that. But today I want to focus on Galbraith's contribution to our understanding of some of the salient trends in the modern food industry and in public health. And that also resonates very much with the origins of Galbraith's contributions. Galbraith was a farm boy. He grew up on a farm, a relatively, well, what Richard Parker, his biography, refers to as a modest farm at 150 acres. That seems quite large to me, but then again, this was in the New World in Canada. But he was also an agricultural economist by training. I interviewed him in 2001 and he made a point of saying that he didn't have an economics degree. Now, Galbraith was one of the first economists to explore the wider ramifications of the advent of a consumer society. Galbraith argued that individual tastes were not exogenous but learned and shaped by cultural, institutional and socioeconomic processes and by particular influences such as advertising. And Galbraith was also one of the first economists to highlight how large firms, as well as the wider economic superstructure, influence consumption and work patterns in a way that can run counter to the wider public interest. He highlighted how the large firms that dominate the food, tobacco, pharmaceutical, automobile, alcohol industries, among many others, use sophisticated marketing techniques to increase sales and to ensure that what is produced is ultimately sold. And the resulting augmented consumption patterns can have harmful health and environmental effects. So, similarly, economic and social pressures to increase working hours and augment incomes have been linked to a range of increases in psychological disorders. And indeed, many health problems can be seen, as this quote by Galbraith in Economics and the Public Purpose attests, to many modern health problems can be seen as consequences of the consumer society ushered in by the modern large corporation and the behaviours that they encourage. Now, although attracting a degree of attention and notoriety around the time of publication, Galbraith's analysis is slipping somewhat from view. So I'm going to try and consider today Galbraith's approach to the firm, highlighting how it characterises the modern food industry and identifying the basis for divergence between private and public interest. And I'm going to highlight how Galbraith's theoretical system illuminates a range of contemporary public health and environmental anxieties and outline a series of emergent regulatory responses. Now, today the firms that produce and sell the majority of goods and services are large, powerful bureaucracies. This was a basic contribution and a point made by Galbraith. But although markets have evolved beyond the mainstream competitive ideal, Galbraith argued that the standard predictions of the consequences of this shift, inefficiency and the ruthless exploitation of economic power, have not been supported by the facts. The modern firm has ushered in an era of tremendous affluence. Few customers of large corporations complain of exploitation. Antitrust laws are seldom invoked, and instances of oligopoly are typically associated with the greatest output and the most robust growth. Now, for Galbraith, this required explanation. Galbraith highlighted how the rise of the modern corporation facilitates tremendous technological change by insulating itself as well as mitigating a variety of market uncertainties. American capitalism in 1952 introduced the idea that America's large and dominating corporations, though they had the power to control markets, also sustained the technical progress that was fundamental to economic growth. But the main argument of American capitalism was, however, that new restraints on private economic power had emerged on the other side of the market to limit the power of large firms, what Galbraith labels countervailing power. Now, in the new industrial states, Galbraith further identified the key dynamics that underpinned the modern business enterprise. At its core, Galbraith's thesis was that advanced technology requires large, dedicated commitments of capital, skilled labour and time, and this is akin to a Williamsonian and a Keynesian view of the emergence of the firm. And as the firm grows and as production processes become increasingly complex and technologically more sophisticated, there is an increasing need of teams of dedicated bureaucratic specialists to administer the decisions of the modern business firm. So echoing the notions of bounded rationality, Galbraith noted that the complexities of modern technology mean that one person can no longer be familiar with all the aspects of engineering, procurement, quality control, labour relations and marketing which are necessary for doing business. So as group decision-making becomes more important, as technical expertise becomes more important, power passes from the individual owner to the people with the requisite knowledge of the production process, what Galbraith referred to as the technostructure. Now, for Galbraith, the technostructure represents a new class, a new factor of production. It is comprised of the diffuse decision-making structures of the large corporation, and it affects the use and promulgation of modern technology. It encompasses a wide array of expertise, encompassing managerial, technical, scientific, legal, engineering, accounting and advertising expertise. And it underpins the expansion of the scientific and educational elites, which accommodates this need. Now, organisation is the manner by which the technical structure achieves coordination and makes decisions, and it's a necessary response. Organisation is a necessary response to complex technology. The technostructure selects the products and chooses production techniques, including the types of workers to employ, the numbers, they develop marketing and pricing policy, they conduct research and development, they are responsible for organising access to finance, be that internal or external, and its decision-making conventions and governance structures permit informed, reliable and coordinated decision making. And to that end, it brings coordination to the firm. Accordingly, the decisive factor, according to Galbraith, in economic success is no longer the heroic individual, but organised intelligence. As Galbraith remarked, it is not individuals but two organisations that power in the business enterprise and power in society has passed. Now, as power passes to the technostructure, and this is an important point, the behaviour of the modern corporation increasingly will reflect its aims and objectives, and the technostructure will choose those goals, those objectives, those strategies that facilitate its survival and reproduction, such as driving growth, controlling and dominating the supply chain, and lobbying governments and regulators, what Galbraith referred to as the protective need, and those which enhance its status and position, such as pursuing technical virtuosity, what Galbraith refers to as the affirmative need. Now, focusing on growth and survival, and we'll come to this in the context of the food industry shortly, directs attention to the policies pursued by the technostructure to make the market more reliable and more predictable. The markets and forces of competition generate considerable uncertainty for the modern firm, and inflexibly making large asset-specific investments over an extended period of time increases the firm's vulnerability to outside threats. So as the price of failure is clearly great, it must be avoided at all costs. So avoiding failure means escaping the tyranny and hazards of markets and competition. So to thrive, the firm must seek to control the market rather than being subservient to it. As investment is in technology is costly, and firms wish to avoid the prospects that after expensive investment there will be little or no demand for the goods they produce, they must be protected. Costs of technological change must be recovered and benefits realised. So this, according to Galbraith, is a primary reason for the observed growth of the large firm and its nexus to the political apparatus. The technical structure through the modern corporation will have to leverage its power to ensure its continued operation, and in doing so reduce the uncertainties that it's subject to. And accordingly, Galbraith outlined five main strategies which are utilised by the technical structure for managing uncertainties. Those are sort of highlighted on the slide. So the firm can either ignore market uncertainty or absorb it by diversification or agglomeration, or more typically, it can mitigate the impact of the markets by suspending it, controlling it, or superseding it. Now, the consequence of such strategies is that traditional measures of concentration will underestimate the power and reach of the large firm, and the book certainly presents quite a lot of evidence to that effect. And we'll come on again to see and hear a little bit about the context of this in the modern food industry. But perhaps the most contentious aspect of Galbraith's thesis was that the modern corporation would seek to mitigate uncertainty by attempting to manage the response of the consumer. I'm sure, as people are aware, in the conventional wisdom, the firm is subservient to the given preferences of consumers. According to Galbraith, consumer demand is not, however, exogenous, but is shaped by institutional processes and by particular influences such as advertising, and it is the need to protect the large investments of capital and time that create a strong incentive to ensure what is produced ultimately gets sold. If large capital outlays are to be recouped, and if the technical virtuosity of the technical structure is to be maintained, then the response of the consumer must be managed. Now, this explains the huge growth in advertising investment in brand management and development by the modern firm. Now, in first articulating the notion of a dependence effect, Galbraith was focusing on the processes of want management. He did so in The Affluent Society. Now, the dependence effect is a portmanteau concept. It embodies passive and active aspects. The passive aspects embody the processes whereby which social norms and localised cultural comparisons induce consumption patterns. This is, in effect, the social pressure to keep up with the Joneses. And the active aspects refer to the contriving of specific social wants, and equally important, the creation and reproduction of a consumer culture. Now, Galbraith accepts that advertising and other attempts at consumer manipulation may not be perfect, but its power, presence and influence must be acknowledged and analysed. Now, in the new industrial state, Galbraith linked the processes of managing the response of the consumer with the need to protect the upfront investments in technology as well as the interests of the technostructure, specifically in response to criticism such as Hayek and Harry Johnson, who said that Galbraith hadn't given a rationale for the management of the consumer. In the new industrial state, Galbraith provided one, linking it to the upfront investments in technology. And this management of the consumer by the firm was referred to Galbraith as the revised sequence. So rather than firms satisfying the wants and demands of the consumer, instead the modern firm accommodates the consumer to the goals of the technical structure and provides a climate of social belief that is favourable to this result. Now, the broader or the revised sequence is broader than just the management of specific consumer demand by the firm, and encompasses the wider forces that reinforce consumerism. Consumers must be able to buy goods as well as desire them, so the technostructure has a vested interest in ensuring this. Now, the organisations that are able to emancipate themselves from the uncertainties of the market are what Galbraith refers to as the planning system, and they account for about half of the economy, and smaller firms populate the other half of this economy that Galbraith refers to as the market system. Now, together, the market system and the planning system comprise what Galbraith refers to as the bimodal view of the modern economy. Now, this is important because the resultant distribution of power, dominance and control of prices by the planning sector means that the terms of trade favour the large corporation. And from that, it's clear that the large corporation exploits both its power for its own ends, seeking a relatively secure and favourable income, and the consequence is that the market system receives a lower and less secure income. And that bimodal view has several ramifications for policy makers in understanding and responding to the influence of the planning system, and can be used to develop new institutional structures, new policy, and meet broader social goals. Now, Galbraith's analysis of large firms and their relationship with small firms is helpful in analysing the modern food industry. The 20th century witnessed a technological revolution in the international food supply chain in an effort to manage and mitigate the uncertainties that surround both food production and consumption. There were unprecedented changes in how food was produced, distributed, consumed and controlled, and this was characterised in many Western economies by a politically aided process of consolidation and concentration. At the turn of the century, giant machinery began to replace human labour, and Fordist thinking was applied to both plant and animal production. Large-scale experimentation was expended on trying to reduce nature's unpredictability. Agricultural chemicals replaced the hoe, feedlots replaced grazing, monoculture replaced small holding. Agriculture has been radically transformed and industrialised by large agrochemical and biotechnological firms, dominated by large technostructures which heavily invest in research and development. The agrochemical industry, which controls the supply of seeds, fertilisers and pesticides, for example, has been extremely has become extremely concentrated. Lang and Clutterbuck point out that in the late 1980s, the top 20 firms accounted for around 90% of sales. By the late 1990s, the number of firms responsible for this level of sales had halved, and at the turn of the millennium, seven were responsible for the same level. Seven large firms responsible for 90% of sales in the agrochemical industry. In 2002, biotech research was 11.4 billion euros in the US and 5 billion euros in Europe on a comparable basis. This research is heavily concentrated in the advanced industrialized countries, with eight countries representing 83% of the total funds spent on biotechnology. And unsurprisingly, and again consistent with the Galbraith's thesis, a significant proportion of this research is underwritten by governments. Indeed, a global science base has emerged, furthering the goals of increasing outputs, ranging from universities, colleges of agriculture, extension services, as well as the whole panoply of ancillary support functions. So, the large corporations undertaking such investments have ushered in a series of major revolutions in the growing of food, such as the mass use of agricultural chemicals, hybrid plant breeding and genetic modification, and the rearing of animals has similarly been subject to a major revolution with the introduction of factory farming, intensive livestock rearing and the prophylactic use of pharmaceuticals to increase weight gain. Similarly, in food processing, we've also witnessed enormous technological advance with increased use of extrusion technologies, fermentation, as well as the wholesale use of cosmetic additives to disguise products and yield consistency. Now, this transformation has delivered tremendous productive advance. There's a relative abundance of cheap, mass-produced food. And again, consistent with Galbraith's thesis, it should be no surprise that this has given rise to a range of contemporary concerns which the theoretical framework of the new industrial states helps explain, passing what Galbraith refers to in Economics and the Public Purpose as the test of anxiety, which is the ability of a useful economics to illuminate the major anxieties of our time. Now, the obsession of the modern food industry in producing ever higher yields and ever larger quantities has given rise to a variety of environmental and public health costs and concerns. The environmental impact of the rapid industrialisation of the global food production chain has been significant, for example, with the collapse of fish stocks, soil erosion, deforestation and falling water tables in key areas of agricultural production. There's been increased public concern regarding the impact of pesticide residues, antibiotics and veterinary drugs, food pathogens, environmental toxins such as lead and mercury, organic pollutants such as dioxins, all on public health. And similarly, nutrigenomics, which aims to unlock the secrets of genes, diets and lifestyle, is also viewed by some public health specialists as targeting rich consumers and the worried well by preying on fears and desires. The modern food industry has been keen to exploit these fears and desires, and there's further concern over the impact of genetically modified crops and foodstuffs on the food chain. All these call for decisive regulatory action. Now, at the same time that agriculture is becoming has become increasingly technologically sophisticated, we've also seen and witnessed the emergence of large firms dominating the global food supply chain. And as Galbraith pointed out in American Capitalism, from those or those from whom the buyer sells and those whom he sells do characteristically have market power. I'm not going to repeat the quotation. It's there on the slide. It's in the paper. But it's quite clear that, and it would be no surprise to Galbraith acknowledging that quotation, that in the United States the market share of the top 20 food manufacturers has doubled since 1967. Lyson and Raymer identify the power and control exhibited by the 10 largest food and beverage corporations, which control over half of the food sales in the United States. Let me say that again. There are 10 large food and beverage organizations which control over half of food sales in the United States. Now, such a rise in concentration of power is, however, increasingly masked by traditional analysis. And Hendrickson and Gronsky have highlighted how conventional measures of concentration do not reveal the extent of vertical integration in the food system in the United States, nor highlight the complex web of global interactions between the top food firms. In the conventional wisdom, the focus of economic power is usually on the individual firm and its market share, but the changing nature of the modern food industry is, however, developing and driving a more complex set of hierarchical power relations between firms and across producers. And as Galbraith argued, indeed, the power of firms can also be exercised through the various relationships with in which the firm is involved, even if it does not hold a majority share. And although acquisition continues to be a dominant strategy for acquiring control of other firms, mergers, joint ventures, partnerships, contracts, and less formalised arrangements such as agreements and side agreements are also used by the modern food industry in consolidating control and market power. Now, the result is that the modern food production system is dominated by large firm and food conglomerates. The food supply chain is increasingly complex and technologically sophisticated, starting with the involvement in biotechnology, extending through production, and ending with highly processed, heavily marketed global food brands. Nestlé, for example, as I'm sure people are aware, produces a diverse range of products ranging from soluble roast and ground coffee and other beverages, dairy products, dietary products, breakfast cereals, infant food, chocolate, confectionery, food services, pet care, food flavours and pharmaceutical products, among the many that are within its brand stables. Similarly, over the last 40 years, McDonald's has emerged as a major global buyer of people, potatoes, beef, chicken and real estate, with a heavy investment in food science and consumer persuasion. Over the last 20 years, the large food firms have sought to further consolidate their brands and influence and increase their market power. Now, this consolidation of brands more prosaically alludes also to the heavy investment in the persuasion and management of the consumer. Given the technologically sophisticated nature of modern food production, it would be no surprise to many that, and should be no surprise to many that, the large firms that dominate and control the modern food production also seek to manage the response of the consumer. And to protect its large investments and market dominance, the large food, retailers, processors and agrichemical firms all undertake huge investments in advertising and brand developments, targeting segmented consumers and drawing on a sophisticated array of marketing techniques. In the marketing language, exploiting psychographics. Now, the food industry's annual advertising budget is $40 billion US dollars, which is higher than the GDP of 70%, higher than the GDP of more than 70% of the world's nations. Now, the aim of such advertising and marketing budgets, which ranges from TV advertisements aimed at various market segments, including children, but also other marketing employees such as supersized portions, distributing toys to children, is increased consumption. And the global brands which are marketed by such advertising, they tend to be, however, highly refined, excessively refined, high in either salt, sugar and saturated fats, or all three combined. It should be no surprise, therefore, that the increasing global dominance of Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Pizza Hut, KFC, Pepsi, and the other large food processing and producing corporations is coinciding with a range of public health epidemics caused by an excessive consumption of salt, sugar, fats, and an underconsumption of fruit and vegetables. I.e., this is the complete opposite of what is recommended by, as in the public interest, by public health officials. It is no surprise that the excessive consumption of energy-dense, high-fat, high-salt foods, as well as sugary and alcoholic beverages, is driving the contemporary health problems of obesity, alcohol abuse, high blood pressure, and the resultant rise in heart disease, liver disease, stroke, and diabetes. So it is no surprise of that emerging range of public health academics, but the social costs of this excess consumption, which are significant, are not borne by the food producers who induce it. For example, the US Center for Disease Control, for example, estimate that the cost of obesity and overweightness in the US is around $117 billion. It is no surprise that we are witnessing an epidemic of childhood obesity, given, as Langenhiesman outlined, in industrial countries, food advertising accounts for around a half of all advertising broadcast during children's TV viewing times. It accounts for a half of all advertising broadcast during children's TV viewing times. For me, that's a startling statistic. Three quarters of food advertisements promote high calorie, low nutrient food. Nevertheless, the food industry has been incredibly slow to respond to the fact that the consumption of its products is driving a range of major public health epidemics. From a Galbraithian perspective, however, it is unsurprising that the resultant information flow from large firms is uneven, that labelling is arbitrary, or that marketing, advertising and sponsorship is designed to influence perception and mitigate the threat of public challenge. The large transnational firm has a strong financial incentive to manage both the consumer and the flow of information, protecting its investments and pursuing its own objectives, even when they diverge from the wider public health interests. But the large firm will not stop there. Instead, it will also seek to manipulate the public interest so it aligns with its own interest. And it is therefore to be expected that the food industry will seek to lobby governments and regulators to protect their own interests. What contemporary economists refer to somewhat opaquely as regulatory capture. Now, meat and dairy producers in the US, for example, have extensively lobbied Congress to protect its own interests and have succeeded and been successful in diluting the Surgeon General's advice to eat less meat and dairy products. Similarly, the food industry in the US has successfully fought off the threat of tobacco-style litigation through the enactment of the 2004 Personal Responsibility in Food Consumption Act, which places responsibility for overeating and obesity firmly with the individual. Now, the resources available to organisations representing consumer interests and public interests against the barrage of food and firm advertising and influence is, however, limited. It is a prime example of what Galbraith refers to as social imbalance. The top 20 food brands in the UK spend around £105 million a year on marketing, while the UK government spends around £5 million each year on healthy eating advice. Coca-Cola alone in the UK spends £27 million in the UK yearly. It spends $1.4 billion US on advertising worldwide, as does McDonald's. So it should be no surprise that although public health programs attempt to alert consumers to the health consequences of their consumption habits, the receptiveness to such warnings and fighting the noise created by the chorus of advertising messages means that the receptiveness tends to be contingent upon a range of and a mixes of income and education. So after a period in which states in developed countries have actively promoted the restructuring of supply chain in the name of efficiency and output maximization, adverse public reaction to these changes in the West is now forcing governments to respond more differently. It's driving better food labelling and reductions in fat and salt and sugar levels in products. And increasingly, more educated consumers are forcing large corporations and retailers to improve product information and promote health-conscious foodstuffs and increase the amount of organic food that is produced. Health foods are also increasingly more increasingly big business, and there are calls for new democratically accountable regulatory organisations to better understand and monitor the link between food safety, food security, nutrition, biotechnology and the environment. And there's a need for a more rigorous harmonisation and enactment and enforcement of international standards, and more contemporary and more comprehensive independent research, monitoring and assessment. And there is also clearly a need to improve and protect children from junk food advertising and follow the lead of both Sweden and Norway, who have banned TV advertisements aimed at children under five. So we need to respond to this this social imbalance. Now, the modern food retail industry also exhibits degrees of elements of both Galbraith's conception of countervailing power and his bimodal view. Where once food retail markets were highly fragmented, consisting of quite small independent retailers, they've since become quite highly concentrated. And this is quite a busy slide highlighting the top 10 food retailers and the countries of operation that they span. But the consequence has been a marginalisation of small independent retailers restricted to acting as convenience stores. And we've witnessed the market domination by a limited number of large format multiple store retailers that attract the majority of consumer spending. Over the period 1993 to 1999, for example, the aggregate concentration of the top 10 grocery retailers in the European Union grew by just under 25%, whereas the market share of the bottom 10 companies in the EU fell by 72%. Now, food retailers have consolidated their position and emerged as the main gateway to between primary producers and consumers. And now, this points to the large retailers using its using their buying power to control a dense global supply chain to pursue its own ends. Now, in the European Union, 110 buying desks control the dynamics of the supply and value chain and source food for nearly 250 million people. I mean, that's phenomenal. That's a phenomenal concentration of buying power. And it's unsurprising that, consistent with the Galbraithian hypothesis, measures of concentration are likely to underestimate the global power of the large corporation in the food retailing industry. Food retailers do provide a source of countervailing power that acts as a constraint on the power of large food manufacturers. And this can drive real benefits for the consumer. And, for example, within 10 years of entering the food trade, Walmart, for example, has driven down market prices by 13%. And clearly this benefits consumers and underpins their expansion. And in response to government and social pressure, food retailers are also driving down salt and fat and sugar content of several of their products. But the large food retailers have also provided, while the large retailers do provide a countervailing response to the rise of large food producers, their impact has not been wholly benign, and that needs to be acknowledged. It should be no surprise that the Competition Commission in the UK in 2000 concluded that, although the industry was securing a good deal for the British consumer, they operate against the public interest by inducing a climate of fear amongst suppliers, they distort competition and they promulgate consumer confusion. Now, the price of food reflects a mix of production, distribution and retailing costs, with the latter ends of that food production supply chain receiving the greatest margins and reflecting the dominance of the global retailers and the fast food chains. But many of the social, economic and environmental costs associated with that complex food and supply and retail change, ranging from low pay, poor working conditions to overfishing, overfarming, overwatering, excessive use of fertiliser and pesticides, as well as the well-documented contribution of the food industry to climate change, are not reflected in the price that the customer pays. And although large retailers and fast food chains have succeeded in driving down the relative price of food, they've this, when combined with a relentless chorus of advertising, has driven increased consumption. But again, this is runs counter to the public health exhortation to reduce the intake of saturated fat, salt and sugars. And again, this contributes to the excess consumption of food, processed food and beverage products that again give rise to the range of public health related problems and is fueling a health and obesity epidemic. So although food companies and retailers are responding to such concerns, at the present time they are largely tokenistic and there is little overhaul of the basic business model. All this calls for a more comprehensive and globally coordinated response to the problems generated by the unquestionable productivity and technological virtuosity of the food industry. So let me conclude. In his analysis of the large corporation, Galbraith was neither blind nor blind to the virtues nor blind to the vices of the large corporation. And future research in the Galbraithian tradition will therefore acknowledge that the fact that the modern food production and agricultural the model of food production and agriculture that is associated with the emergence of the large agribusinesses and food processes has been successful in raising outputs, but it should also acknowledge and analyse the underlying causes of major public health anxieties, and it needs to explore the range of regulatory responses that will increase the alignment with the public interest. I think I should stop there.
Well, one or two questions I would like to ask. Before I do, I'll ask Robert to respond to that.
First of all, many, many thanks for inviting me. I'm a bit hesitant to say, well, it is a real privilege to be here, coming from well, I was educated in the Red Brick University, and coming to another one, I'm delighted to be somewhat relieved to see. And also, I was a bit hesitant at the invitation as well when I saw the title of Stephen's paper, because I obviously come from a part of the world, West Central Scotland, which is known for its love of the deep fried Mars bar and other such rich cuisine. It's a great privilege to be here, and it's fantastic to be commenting on one of the foremost scholars on Galbraith, I think in terms of the comments I would like to make, they're wholly sympathetic in terms of the tenor of the message. There may be slight nuanced differences, but aren't they always? I think what Stephen's done in this paper is identify in a very, very effective fashion — it's an incredibly well written paper — identify in a very effective fashion the need for a political economy of food. Ben Fine has done something similar in terms of consumption more generally, but I think this is an incredibly valuable piece in terms of it does so many things. It goes beyond what it says in the tin, to use a reference to a successful advertising campaign. I think it identifies really the social imbalances via Galbraithian framework, but it also identifies the problems of abundance. And this is something that seems to me beyond the current mainstream, which of course is still wedded to issues of scarcity. And as a means of demonstrating that, I'd like to use two quotes, I think, that embody your message, and both are taken from the Affluent Society. And I thank you for reminding me of the prominence of Galbraith. It's encouraged me to go back to my bookshelf and look at his works after a probably too long a period of time. But the first quote taken from the Affluent Society is that the final problem of the productive society is what it produces, essentially the mix of production. This manifests itself as an implacable tendency to provide an opulent supply of some things, a niggardly yield of others. The problem of abundance, and of course social imbalance as well. And I think this is beautifully demonstrated by a quote that appears earlier in the book about something as mundane as cleaning your house. Set great store by increase in private wealth. Vacuum cleaners to ensure clean houses are praiseworthy and essential to our standard of living. Galbraith's talking about what would be added in gross domestic product. Street cleaners to ensure clean streets are an unfortunate expense. Partly as a result, our houses are generally clean and our streets generally filthy. And I think this, even written prior to the 1960s, this still carries a tremendous force today. And I think Stevens advanced a Galbraithian thinking in the theatre of food and food production. So I don't want to speak for too long because I'm entirely sympathetic with the case, and I'd like to open it up for discussion. But I will identify what for me are important discussion points, I feel. So I'll be perhaps excessively brief in trying to outline or recap Stephen's case, and I'll offer latterly some, as I say, some sympathetic but nevertheless critical observations, certainly from my own perspective. The points in the slide there, I think, identify the critical arguments that Stephen employs. And for me, the analytical entry point is the Galbraithian, Veblenian, and more latterly, been very effectively articulated by Jeff Hodgson, amongst others, this notion of the malleable individual, that our wants are not just given. We have a certain social construction to our wants. I always tell the tale to introductory students about my own first experience of an anecdote in terms of smoking. My then pal, his father worked in the Soviet Union, which was very unusual for its time in the 1980s. And I hasten to add the early 1980s, unfortunately. He stole a packet of cigarettes from his father, who was a heavy smoker, and my first introduction to cigarettes was unfiltered Russian-tipped cigarettes, and of course that led to a bout of severe vomiting and put me off cigarettes for life. But that, I think that anecdote is nevertheless highly instructive about where did this want to consume a cigarette come from. It was peer group pressure, the malleable individual. And I think that's a critical insight, especially in articulating a case such as this, where there's obviously, as Stephen outlined to very good effect in this presentation, there's obvious incredible power. We could talk about the dimensions of this power. I think that some of the nuances of this power perhaps don't appear in the paper. And how you've articulated it in terms of, well, the obvious constraints of space. But I think the key insight here that's beyond mainstream economics is this notion of the malleable individual. It goes beyond methodological individualism, and I think it articulates and resonates incredibly well with a Veblenian approach. And next is a class analysis, perhaps a bit more Marxist for some people's liking, but I think this is wonderful in terms of the rise of the professional managerial class and how this articulates and shapes, almost like Marx in terms of the capitalist superstructure, shapes the not just our production relations, but our social relations. And I think Galbraith captures this incredibly well with this notion of want management that Stephen states in the paper, the revised sequence that, again, contrary to the mainstream approach of economic approach of analysing issues of consumer demand and consumption, we're talking about the social construction of wants. And that brings me nicely onto the nature of the multidimensional nature of firm power, and obviously Stephen's papers about agriculture and food. And there it seems incredible in terms of the workplace, in terms of what's happening to, if you like, workers' rights, to put it in those sorts of terms, trade union power, negligible if it exists at all in this sort of sector. Low pay, low skill tends to dominate. Incredible market power, incredible firm power. But there's also the power, I think, that Stephen talks about, and it goes back to the malleable individual, the power of seduction. The power of seduction is incredible in this sector, vis-a-vis not just advertising, but vis-a-vis all sorts of marketing campaigns that go on. Stephen alluded to them in the paper, but not in his talk, in terms of the promotional gifts. And it's almost the capture of the consumer and the promulgation of this consumer society. So there is this real notion of the power of seduction. And of course that brings us nicely on to the social costs, the consequence of this power, being that, of course, we have Galbraith, the central Galbraithian insight in this respect, where we have the privatisation of benefits and the socialisation of costs. So essentially that the costs aren't borne by the producers. Again, it goes beyond this notion of an externality. I think Stephen alluded to it beautifully in terms of the problem of abundance. We at an anecdotal level, we see it all around us in terms of people's health, real public health issues, the rising childhood rates of obesity, and obviously this is coupled with the changes in our lifestyle. And also I think this marries neatly into other issues of lifestyle that suit the consumption of these particular products. Stephen mainly talks about in the earlier part of this paper the high fatty foods, heavily salted. People, young kids, no longer seem to go out to play anymore. Certainly not in the same degrees. And of course, modern technology has helped exacerbate perhaps these problems in terms of the social activities that many people engage in, which tend to discourage exercise unless you're playing with a Wii. So I think this again engages with Galbraith's, as I'll say later, overarching architecture that he paints. It's an emerging property. So I think there are important conceptual insights, evolutionary approaches and issues of emergence. And then in the paper, Stephen identifies latterly this notion of countervailing power, and this is where I might depart from the nuance of Stephen's argument a bit, in terms of he identifies a countervailing power for very good reasons, arguably, in terms of the concentration of food retailers, how this acts as a counterweight to the purchasing the production power of food producers, and how this has acted to benefit the consumer in terms of driving the relative price of food down in the West, it has to be said. Elsewhere, it seems to be very different in terms of rising food prices staple food prices that have set off in previous years, riots in Egypt, Indonesia and so forth. And of course we have the rise of consumer goods, consumer groups. Stephen in the paper emphasises the importance of education and income in this, and I think that's an insight that is in danger of being lost when we're talking about public health issues, lumping together the population as some sort of homogenous whole. So we have the rise even of ethical consumption and so forth, which I might touch on, which we'll certainly touch on later. But the paper also states at the beginning that there's an intention to explore a range of regulatory responses, and I think this is perhaps where we could explore further, because in my view, whilst the paper identifies several aspects of this, it's worth exploring further, and perhaps the paper could do so. Yeah. Perhaps we'll talk about that. So I shall leave it there in terms of this sets up nicely the nature of the latter part of my comments. Do I have about 5 minutes left?
Sure.
I'm all right. I don't want to take up too much time, obviously, but I think in terms of the conceptual aspects, I think the paper is an incredible... it weaves Galbraith's concepts. And I agree completely with what you're saying about the complexity of Galbraith's analysis. It's underappreciated in many circles. It weaves Galbraith's tale, for want of a better word, with incredible precision and skill. And I think it fits well with the overarching schema that Galbraith has, this notion of the prominence of a particular type of production that is identified, I think, in the economics of the public purpose and the affluent society, this dominance of the technostructure. So it's a particular paramount position of a particular type of production and production class, so that shapes not just what we consume, but it shapes our lifestyles. So Galbraith talked about the rise of convenience goods, the rise of dishwashers, for example, to aid domestic lifestyles, to make these mundane tasks, to reduce the time of these mundane tasks in order to expand the labour force. Some have argued that with the entry of women into the labour force, it can suppress wages in some sectors, and I think Galbraith would have certain sympathies with this. So I think Stephen's argument fits nicely into this sort of notion of the overarching schema that Galbraith certainly paints in his various works. The other aspect, I think, that doesn't come through as forcefully in the paper is certainly emphasised in Galbraith's, correct me if I'm wrong, Galbraith's later work, the Culture of Contentment, is this notion of the toleration of the underclass. And I think this is where it's important to appreciate the uneven consumption patterns that exist with these sorts of foodstuff that and dare I say outlets that Stephen's identified, the McDonald's, the KFCs, where these consumption patterns do differ. And I think this is a manifestation of what Galbraith says is this notion of an underclass that's slightly divorced from, if you like, the richer parts of society. Not saying that doesn't present its problems, that they don't have their problems in terms of overconsumption of certain goods in its own right, but nevertheless, there is, at least as far as I'm aware of, some evidence to suggest that the problems of particular types of obesity, alcohol consumption, the consumption of fatty foods are... Whilst obviously a problematic regardless of social background, are particularly concentrated in various social backgrounds, poorer areas of society in particular. I was struck, another anecdote, I was struck by this. I recently visited the US, and there's a public health advertising campaign in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it's aimed at a African American, young African American mothers, and it's instructing them not to take their young children, babies into bed with them, because of the greater incidence of obesity in this particular group in society. What's being found is that when the young mothers fall asleep, they tend to there's been unfortunate act cases where they've rolled on top of their young child and basically smothered them. So that has prompted a public health response. And I think, again, it's a problem of, yes, abundance, but also scarcity as well. So I think there's this this argument could be brought out further, I think, in the paper. The second point, the second major point in the slide there, food retailers as a source of countervailing power, I found that I said yes, but I think in terms of this, there's the obvious point that yes would be in terms of how food retailers and the concentrated market power that they have driven down prices, certainly for the consumers. And Stephen has identified in the papers how this isn't necessarily a one-way street in terms of the generation of benefits. I feel that there is more of an alignment with these retailing sectors and the producers than is perhaps necessarily the case prima facie from looking at this notion of the countervailing power. Some of the cases that are identified in the paper, some of the examples like McDonald's, KFC and so forth, aren't necessarily dealing with the food retailing sections, the Walmarts, the Tescos and so forth. It seems that there is a difference in nuance going on there. There are issues, of course, that identified with vertical integration, but I think there's an important limitation in the notion of countervailing power here with the food retailing sector. And in many circumstances, I feel that there could be a temptation to overstate this notion of a countervailing power on the food producers. The second point I think neatly fits in is that this sector as a whole is engaging with this notion, perhaps in a fig leaf fashion, of corporate social responsibility. And that may well have been generated by countervailing power from consumer groups, the educated groups that you're talking about. But nevertheless, in terms of this notion of corporate social responsibility, I think Stephen has brought this out in his argument fairly effectively. It's even citing Paul Krugman in terms of the manipulation that goes on in the funding of research. I think it's a vitally important point, and it's certainly not unique to the food sector. So this notion of corporate social responsibility is again being manipulated. And of course, the large food producers such as Kellogg's do try to engage with the health debate in terms of the production of cereals and the way that they pitch their marketing campaigns. We are corporate socially responsible in that we are promoting a healthier lifestyle. This is part of a healthier lifestyle, almost. I think the issue of ethical consumption as well could be brought further out as an instance of countervailing power. Whilst I would agree completely with Stephen that the countervailing power, perhaps we disagree, countervailing power, the instances of it, I think, are incredibly muted, given the dominance of the producers. I think in terms of ethical consumption, what we have seen are important framing issues in terms of how it's shaped some corporate responses. I'm thinking, for example, of boycotts of South African produce during the apartheid era, and so forth. That certainly has informed some opinions. The final point in the couple of seconds I'll take is that it comes back to what I said about policy and setting out exploring the ranges of regulatory responses. And perhaps this is down to the paucity of regulatory responses that there has been. I feel that Stephen in the paper identified, as far as I could see, two principal policy responses, and that related to food labelling, which is pretty piecemeal, certainly in the European Union, and I think even more so in the US, North America. And that's only where they can make health claims, And of course, making a health claim is difficult to define. It's certainly difficult to define. If you make a lifestyle claim, it's not the same as a health claim, perhaps. And the second one regarded the practice of advertising, but I think there's so much more that could be explored in this, and perhaps because of the constraints of the length of the paper, Stephen wasn't able to do this. And I also think there's an important international dimension here. I think that engages incredibly well with Galbraith. I've put up a quote from the 8-9 years ago from the World Health Organization, World Health Report, and they tend to reiterate this through the report. So most of the findings of the report emphasise the global gap between the haves and the have-nots by showing us just how much of the world's burden is the result of undernutrition among the poor and overnutrition of those of us who are better off, wherever they live. The contrast is shocking, at the same time that there are 170 million children in poor countries who are underweight, and so many die from malnutrition. There are more than 1 billion adults worldwide who are overweight. And of course, I think this identifies, perhaps in a slightly different way, the twin problems of abundance and scarcity. The social imbalances that Galbraith highlighted, the uneven consumption, uneven development in this context. And I think that's an important factor in terms of, yes, whilst food prices have been driven down perhaps in the West, perhaps in the wrong type of foodstuffs for a start, and that might well explore issues of taxation policies. It also brings into sharp relief, I think, rising food prices as a result of supranational policies, perhaps post-Washington consensus, liberalisations of developing economies, domestic economies, where foodstuffs experience variations, and quite considerable variations of prices. And of course, this opens up the avenue to commodity trading that exists now in basic foodstuffs such as soybeans and so forth, where again I think a Galbraithian approach would be very insightful, where the prices of these sort of basic foodstuffs are oscillating incredibly. So to round off, I'd like to congratulate Stephen on a very stimulating paper. I enjoyed reading it thoroughly. It's an invaluable contribution, I think, to a very important debate, I would say, in old-style political economy, arguably. And I think it shows the value of Galbraith in very sharp relief. I congratulate you again.